This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Downing. Our guest this week is Lori Wayburn, president and co-founder of Pacific Forest Trust. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with PFT's Lori Wayburn next. America's 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers count on a strong U.S. sugar policy to keep American consumers supplied with an essential ingredient. Better yet, it's designed to cost taxpayers nothing. These farmers support more than 151,000 jobs throughout the sugar supply chain in both urban and rural communities. They contribute over $23 billion to the economy each year and help keep it sweet in America. Learn how the Farm Bill supports sugar crop farmers and workers at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Forest lands are one of our nation's most valuable resources, providing more than just agriculture products, helping our planet cope with a changing climate, and providing essential natural resources for our very existence. 33 years ago, Lori Wayburn helped to begin Pacific Forest Trust with a mission of working with private forest landowners to preserve timber and forest lands.
And at that time, there was no real voice for private forest lands in the United States, interestingly enough, that really advocated around their conservation overall, as well as stewardship. The mindset was very much about an advocacy battle over the national forests and old growth, and to the degree that private forest landowners were known, especially in the West, it was that there should be no clear-cutting of old growth, and frankly, no clear-cutting at all. So it was a very tense time. And in founding the Pacific Forest Trust, our co-founder, Connie Best, who is now formally retired, but she's also our strategic advisor, our feeling was, if you will, that missed the forest for the trees, because 60%, and at that time 63%, of all forests in the U.S. were privately owned. And old growth was a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage, less than half of a half of a percent. So while we are very empathetic with that issue and feel there's old growth is likely irreplaceable, that really the opportunity lay in ensuring that we worked with private forest landowners overall to understand what the situation was with private forest lands, what drove them, and how to help support them so that we did conserve them for all their benefits. So that's the founding thesis about how do we build up a system of incentives that support forest landowners to keep their land as forest and to manage it for all the benefits that forests provide.
Recognizing that there is public forest land and there's private forest land, is it safe to assume that we all benefit from the forests?
Forests are the very large majority of the source of our drinking water. Forests have more biodiversity, more variety of plants, fish, and wildlife than any other habitat type. Forests cover a third of the U.S. They cover a third of the world. And forests are the most critical, underappreciated foundation for solving the climate crisis that we have.
The Pacific Forest Trust, creating new economic incentives, rewarding private forest owners for conserving their lands and practicing sustainable forestry. Can you expand on that?
Forests are more than a collection of trees. Forests are more than a source of timber and fiber. Forests are where we get our water, they clean our air, they stabilize our climate, they are the habitat for an enormous variety of species. A lot of our pollinators A lot of our pest control, like bats, come from forests primarily. So we often talk about forests as if it was about timber supply. And timber supply is a critical feature of forests because you can maintain a timber supply from forest lands. But it's really difficult to maintain the whole forest if you only rely on timber to pay the bills. And that drives a second thing, Jeff, that most people don't know. We lose twice as many acres of forest land every year to development as we lose farmlands. We understand that we can't afford to lose farmlands because there goes our food supply. Fewer people understand that you can't afford to lose forest lands at this rate either. But if you can't pay the bills, or if the higher value of the property is for development, that is what people will often choose, even if they didn't want to. And so that's where our operating thesis of how can we develop financial and regulatory incentives to help people keep their land as forest and as forest broadly. So managing for the whole forest, using timber and timber products as one of a suite of ways to pay for the property.
Some ideas on stewardship are to put a fence around it, leave it alone, and don't touch it.
You know, this is the world in black and white when most of the world should be a rainbow. To work with forests, it's helpful to remember that people have always been part of forests and that forests are part of our culture. Our forests are so different today than they were 300, 150 years ago that to walk away from our responsibility to manage forests appropriately as forests is a grave mistake. That's what leads to the kinds of megafires, pest outbreaks, diseases, tree death that we see. We have so altered what our forests look like in terms of the species that are there, the number of trees per acre, the ages of those trees, whether or not those trees are native or they are non-native in terms of, you know, are they exotics, are they invasives? There's a lot of reasons to love being involved with your forest. So if you ask me, is the way to do it to put a fence around it and walk away? The answer would be no. One of the really interesting things, Jeff, about forests is they are much longer lived than we are. If you will, they're like all of humanity. Forests continue, but an individual tree life or an individual person's life is only a portion of that. But those individual tree lives, by and large, particularly on the West Coast, but also all over this country, trees live hundreds to thousands of years. So our view of stewardship also needs to be intergenerational. It needs to go beyond any individual person or any individual owner. So recognizing that that forest is a legacy for communities, frankly, for the country.
Let's talk about the president's letter where you offered a phrase, bet against or bet on nature. What did you mean?
When it comes to the question of climate change, there are people who think, you know, it's a little bit like the weather roulette. This year, I'm fortunate where I live that it's been cool. We haven't had massive heat domes. We haven't had significant fires. We didn't have those extraordinarily intense rainstorms that you're seeing all over the country right now. So this year we were fortunate. So betting against nature is to say, I want to be in that fortunate place all the time. But as we can see by what is happening across the country and the globe, it's really hard to bet against the house. But that's what a number of financial institutions will do. That's where I was bringing up this concept of a catastrophe bond, bet against nature that this time you're gonna make it. But betting on nature is about leveraging the power of our natural and working lands to really help us in this climate crisis. And what I mean by climate crisis is that climate change is more than about carbon dioxide absorption. So even if you could snap your fingers and create geologic sequestration in a significant way, which you cannot, it's going to take billions of dollars and a number of years, we actually have a tool in nature to significantly increase both our carbon dioxide storage and our resilience and adaptation. What I mean by resilience and adaptation is, how do your lands weather it when there's a heat dome? How do they respond to too much rain all at once? Land has more capacity to help us than any other sector. So betting on nature is to say, to weather this climate crisis, we need to be investing in our lands and our land owners to be able to do the kind of stewardship that will help us through this extraordinarily stressful time.
What's needed? And I noted there's a piece of legislation, the Forest Legacy Management Flexibility Act, with Representative Garamendi and Ken Calvert. What's in that legislation that will help landowners improve the health of their forest land?
Well, there are a couple things there that I'd love to touch base on, Jeff. One is about how we improve the health and productivity and function, the overall function of our forests. You're absolutely right. It doesn't happen overnight, but it's a little bit and rather remarkably like human health. You know, when you need to get healthy, you know there's a certain diet you should have, a certain amount of exercise you should have, a certain amount of fluids you should have, and you work on those elements over time. You don't snap your fingers and wake up a different person the next day. And part of what you're doing is seek to get back to your body's healthy, regular, normal function, its natural function. That's exactly what we need to be doing with forests. That's when forests are more resilient and they're more able to take stress. So what we need to be doing with our forests, number one, is we want to keep them as forests. So that means compensating landowners for keeping them as forests. And number two is helping them make that change in management to restore their health and natural function. So wherever we can find policies and legislation that enable landowners to help themselves, if you will, that's really key to restoring that health and productivity and function. So the Forest Legacy Program is a federal funding program to support states in their efforts to protect private forest lands as forest lands, working forest lands as working forest lands. Historically, that program has been controlled by governmental agencies. A lot of landowners would prefer to work with private voluntary land trusts as opposed to a government agency. One concept your listeners may be familiar with is a conservation easement, and that's a tool that landowners can use to protect their lands for the future, to protect their legacies for the future. A conservation easement is a legal document that's a restricted interest in land that says that future owners won't develop it and they won't liquidate its resources, for example. And this Forest Legacy Program funds those conservation easements. Many, many landowners would like the options, and many states would like the option of working with private voluntary land trusts, accredited land trusts across the country that are the neighbors and regional partners for landowners and governments to hold those interests in land. So it's a simple program to give more power to the states to implement a federal state program for the state's goals of protecting those private forest lands. Rightly or wrongly, an awful lot of landowners don't want the government as their forever partner. So all this piece of legislation would do is give states the option to work with a private accredited voluntary land trust to help them fulfill that program.
So would this piece of legislation fall under the rest of the Farm Bill? Would it be standalone? What hope for a vehicle do you see of bringing it to fruition?
Bills move in an unpredictable way in Congress. And the Farm Bill does not look like it's moving terribly rapidly at the moment. That is one way to include this and move it forward. But other vehicles are moving more quickly, and we'll just see which one makes the most sense. I doubt that it ever would be a standalone piece of legislation. Congress doesn't operate in that way at this time. So it would need to be attached to another more relevant piece of legislation that is moving.
Is there a price tag associated with this piece of legislation?
No. I mean, that's the great thing. It saves the government, both federal and state, money to do that. I mean, it frees up state agencies to do more critical mission core work so that they, for a number of states, while this is important to them, it's not, for example, the same importance as managing forest fire responses. It's not as important as overseeing the implementation of their forest practice acts. It's not as important as helping provide advice on harvest and so on. So they believe in its mission, but they just don't have the staffing or the budgets to do it. And this allows them to leverage their partnerships that already exist with landowners and land trusts to implement it. But it doesn't cost anything for the federal government, and it saves states money.
So while we all benefit from forest land, the question is, where does the responsibility fall to keep them up and to manage them? Is that a combination of federal, state, local, and the landowner, or does it all fall on the landowner, knowing they may only harvest once in a lifetime?
So that's such an excellent point. So land is regulated at the state level. Private land is regulated at the state level. There are two laws at the national level that have been utilized, but it's more through that federal-state implementation. So the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act indirectly impact forest land management. But what really happens is at the state and county level in terms of a regulatory oversight with that. And equally with state wildlife or fish and wildlife, that's a state-level responsibility. So this goes back to that question. Private landowners are very aware of, if you will, their rights and responsibilities. But markets or financial ways to pay landowners for those broader benefits of forests are limited. Conservation easements is a huge one. And in the forest industry arena, conservation has become a big element that they look at in terms of their sources of financial return. For private landowners, there's maybe not as much knowledge or information disseminated about how they can use conservation easements to help support what they want to do on their lands. The kinds of easements that we do with Pacific Forest Trust will typically bring back almost half the value of the property. And landowners that we've worked with use that to reinvest in their land, to expand their forest land holdings, to pay down debt. It really has been a huge benefit for them to keep their family lands working and setting up future generations to be able to continue.
Lori, I noted from the information that you provided in advance of our interview that you can't avoid fire. Fire occurs. So how do we as stewards of forest lands work with fire and prevent catastrophic loss? Is that possible?
You know, it's absolutely possible. Like other things you've mentioned, it is a process because it took us many decades to get to this difficult situation where we have uncharacteristic and very large fires, these so-called mega fires. And it will take us some time to get back into a better balance around fire. There was the Bipartisan Wildfire Commission that issued its report a little over a year ago, and it outlined a whole series of activities that need to happen, and one of which is to better manage fire to manage fire. All of the systems in this country were fire adapted several hundred years ago. Fires happened fairly frequently. They were low intensity, and they were net-net pretty beneficial. They maintained the meadows that we relied on. They maintained the watersheds that we relied on. They put charcoal into the soil. They controlled pests and diseases and fungal infections. Fungi are great, but some fungi are not so great in terms of, you know, killing trees. But in our current situation, in the West, we have many, many forests that have far too many trees to the acre, too many straws in the ground for the amount of water that is there. And that has led to tree mortality, to fire, being more fire prone as opposed to fire adapted. And what we need to be doing is recognizing fire is still the largest treatment we have on the landscape for, so good fire is the largest treatment that we have available to treat bad fire. And what I mean by that is over 60% of all the fires in the West are low to moderate intensity. Net, they're beneficial. But that leaves you with the other portion that isn't. So it means that that low to moderate intensity fire covers many, many more acres than what we can do with our fuels reduction efforts. And what we need to be doing and what many states are moving towards and what the Forest Service had been moving towards is getting key portions of the forest in shape to take fire safely and allowing other areas that don't have people, that don't have structures, allowing it to burn in those areas at a broad scale. So that lowers the risk for everybody. Because what our prior fire suppression policy was unintentionally incredibly successful at was only leading to the fires that got out of control. So the big fires were those, the ones that we couldn't control. We weren't using this low and moderate intensity fire approach to reduce the amount of fuel in the forests so that when fires come, they burn closer to the ground, lower flame lengths, don't create those pyroclastic clouds. They don't create the disasters.
What about the DOGE efforts that reduce staff, reduce firefighters, reduce those who share responsibility in caring for our force?
Frankly, I think those have been not very well informed. When I look at the people that I have worked with in the Forest Service, in the Department of Agriculture, in the Fish and Wildlife Service, I think it's very true when one of the federal administration said, we're taking a hatchet and not a scalpel. Well, true. And a lot more damage has been done than benefit. Yes, there are areas where you can reduce inefficiency and increase effectiveness. But these blanket approaches to just chopping things away and then being told by the courts to bring them back and then staying that and, you know, the flipping and flopping here has really been very demoralizing for people. I'll give you an example. I was out on a national forest district a few weeks ago and their staffing has been cut in one area from 6 to 1. That poor person can't take care of all the toilets, all the campgrounds, all the water, you know, water pumps, getting rid of dangerous trees, keeping the trails up. They can't do it. And we all know that people love to recreate in the national forest. We need to keep that staffing. There's no way that that person is also going to be able to handle the fire response that is likely to have to happen or potentially could happen this summer or even next summer. From the very, very practical, like keeping the bathrooms open, to the more existential, like getting out warnings and having people on the phone to talk to if there is a fire coming. These are not well-informed decisions often that have been being made and are frankly pretty counterproductive in some cases. I realize that sounds critical, but I think it could be better.
Well, Laurie Wayburn, we want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us and share information about this very, very important topic. We certainly appreciate the work of Pacific Forest Trust. I've asked all the questions, Laurie. Now it's time for you to have the final word today.
Jeff, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. And I think in terms of a final word, you know that phrase, may the forest be with you? May you be with the forest as well. Because I think it's essential for us to recognize that people are part of nature. People exist within a forest context. Many people are in cities. They don't know about that connection anymore. But we need to revitalize that because whether you live in a city and you just enjoy being out in trees or whether you live out in rural communities and forests are part of your everyday life, they help weave us together and they make our lives better. And in turn, we need to take care of them so they keep taking care of us. I really appreciate a chance to talk with you today about that.
Our thanks to Laurie Wayburn, president and co-founder of Pacific Forest Trust, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance, a America's sweetest industry, creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Elliott.